Good morning. Welcome to the Macro Show. I'm Kevin Peel, here with macro analyst Aries Dale. I'll start you guys off with the asset allocation here. As a reminder, this table, it's represented as a percentile of the maximum preferred exposure for each respective asset class. So cash is at 64% of max exposure, U.S. and international equities both at 0%, commodities 18%, foreign exchange 12%, and fixed income 79% of max exposure. And with that, I'll hand it off to Darius.
Awesome. Thanks, Kevin. And thanks for joining us this morning here on the Hedgeye Macro Show. So let me get started with the top three things in Keith's Macro Notebook, and then we'll move on to a special presentation we prepared for you guys on China this morning, and then we'll wrap it up with some thoughts and commentary on the U.S. In light of our allegedly very confusing macro show yesterday. So starting with the Eurozone, number one, it's almost daily now that we get confirmation that the belief system in the Eurozone is broken. Eurogroup President Dijsselbloem was out yesterday in a speech at the Peterson Institute saying the current interest rate environment acts as a tailwind for our economy. It supports the economy in the short run, but the effect is short-lived, and it simply cannot foster a sustainable recovery if underlying structural problems are not addressed, which is exactly something we've been saying for, I don't know, 8 or 9 years now. We remain bearish on the region, grounded by our GIP model, which spells quad four pressure in the back half of this year. So number two, crude oil. Whether it's output cut rumors into this weekend's meeting or declining U.S. production, the quote-unquote bottom is in headlines are at the top of commodity feeds from every major news source, with WTI up roughly 40% over the last 3 months. So looking at contract positioning shorts, quite a consensus short positioning in basically most of the energy complex and really across the full commodities complex has actually been washed out. So the net futures and options speculative positioning is all registering Z scores of greater than 1x on a trailing 12-month basis. So effectively, you know, on the margin, money has been betting on a continued decline in the dollar and continued reflation, and we're basically making the case that we're starting to get to really overstretched levels in terms of consolidation from here. That's not to say these, you know, trades can't go on a little longer here, but we're definitely getting to the point where we're starting to get to bump up against some sort of structural resistance as it relates to being marginally bearish on the dollar and marginally bullish on commodities with respect to futures and options contracts. So again, you know, supply side story is definitely a fundamental story, and it's additive to the catalyst or additive to the outlook for crude oil. But it itself is not necessarily a catalyst. It's definitely a fundamental driver over the long term, but it's not necessarily a catalyst. And what we think will catalyze a reversal in a lot of the commodity inflation we've seen over the intermediate term is a reversal in the dollar and the Chinese yuan, which is the last thing. So the last theme is China. So this week concluded with another made-up data dump out of everyone's favorite communist economy, rather. So Chinese GDP growth allegedly ticked down to minus 10 basis points to 6.7% year over year, and the quarter allegedly ended on a positive note with retail sales, industrial production, fixed asset investment, money supply, and total social financing growth all accelerating sequentially in March. You know, while we've been effectively right on our call for both the Chinese economy and the Chinese yuan to avoid effectively falling off a cliff over the intermediate to long term, a lot of the reprieve in Chinese capital outflows and the rate of change in Chinese growth has actually been perpetuated by a reversal of the trend of the depreciation in the PBOC's yuan fixing. But effectively now we're calling for that trend to reverse. So as the US dollar starts to make a series of higher lows versus peer currencies, and we expect that to meaningfully increase pressure on the Chinese yuan and then both onshore and offshore from here, and we expect that to propagate another bout of global deflation fears over the next 3 to 6 months, so effectively a redo of what we saw in early January. So just sticking with China, you know, I prepared a presentation for you guys this morning to really sort of hammer home our sort of intermediate to long-term thoughts on the Chinese economy. We extracted these slides from, you know, our 100-page slide deck we put out on EM last month. These are some of the key highlights as it relates to our outlook for the Chinese yuan and the Chinese economy, but there's probably another, you know, 40 or 50 to choose from. So to the extent you guys haven't seen that deck, just ping sales@hedgeye.com, and we'll make sure we get that over to you for the right price, of course. All right, so starting with this first slide on slide 9 here, you know, this is one of the key slides in the deck, sort of a picture is worth 1,000 words. So we're effectively showing the three schools of thought, you know, when it comes to China. You know, none of them are really positive. You know, it's sort of, you know, what rate of exponential decay are you projecting, and does that exponential decay sort of, you know, materialize into broad-based collapse? So we're decidedly in the middle camp, which is that black line there. You know, we definitely expect the Chinese economy and the Chinese yuan to make a series of lower highs over the intermediate to long term. There's definitely a camp out there that, you know, that's more in the red, more attuned with the red line, that expects a sort of sudden stop risk, crisis risk, certainly in the banking sector, and that'll obviously perpetuate itself through the currency as you know, the Chinese policymakers start to opt to use foreign exchange reserves to prop up their or to at least, you know, sort of recapitalize their banking sector and sort of delever their economy. On the next slide, we're basically saying why we think we're in the black line, or this is one of the main reasons we think we're in the black line. So really, China has no incentive to devalue. So, you know, Beijing prefers stability, both economically and financial market-wise. And so, you know, they obviously had a little trouble promoting financial stability in the second half of last year. We can all agree that they basically made a mistake with the pretty material devaluation we saw in August. And obviously, they made a huge mistake in sort of trying to prop up equity prices really all throughout last year as the early 2015 bubble started to collapse. But the point I'm making with this chart here is, you know, we're just going back and showing you, you know, a lot of the Asian tiger currencies. And, you know, during the Asian financial crisis, they all sort of had these, you know, material one-off devaluations. And the point we're making with this chart is that it's never just a one-off thing. China's not going to just magically wake up and devalue the yuan 10, 15, 20%, and that's it. That it never ends that way. So if, you know, you look at the Thai baht, you know, their initial devaluation was 16%. And then over the next year from that 16% devaluation, the Thai baht dropped 49%. Philippine peso, initial devaluation, 10.3%. Oh, we had a nice little 10% revaluation. We can use foreign exchange reserves to prop up the bank system. No, down another 35% from there. Same thing with Malaysian ringgit, down 2.4%. Another 46% from there. And Indonesian rupiah, down 6%. Down another 85% from there. South Korean won, down almost 10%. Then another 45% from there. So the purpose we're making with this chart is really sort of twofold. One, it's never a one-off devaluation. What you see with currency crises is that, you know, you really start to perpetuate capital outflows when you start to really materially devalue, and those capital outflows tend to really push your exchange rate down by a dramatic degree that sort of counteracts any sort of stimulus you're receiving either on the export front or on the foreign exchange front in terms of converting those into capital in the banking sector. So, you know, again, China knows this. You know, if I can figure this out, you know, certainly the brilliant guys at MIT and Harvard and schools like Yale, where you and I went, can figure this out, you know, who are running the state council and who run the PBOC. Next chart here, so effectively, again, you know, we definitely don't think China has a ton of structural pressure for a really long-standing period of capital outflows. You know, we showed a few charts in the aforementioned deck that, you know, a lot of the capital outflow pressure we've seen in China to date has really just been a function of prepayment of foreign currency debt, which China doesn't have a ton of. And also reduce sort of offshore banking deposits, you know, which you know reduce local foreign currency deposits on the mainland as well, you know. So you know, the Chinese outlook for the Chinese yuan has really shifted from a one-way appreciation bet to a more two-sided debate. To even, you know, I would argue in January to a pretty one-sided debate to the downside. You know, a lot of that capital outflow pressure really materialized. But again, it's not necessarily something that could really sustain itself from my perspective. So what we're showing in these next few charts is really just China's, you know, foreign currency risk. And so in this first chart here, we're just showing foreign currency assets as a percentage of total banking sector assets. And unfortunately, you know, the most recent date is 2013. But, you know, again, you know, this, you know, apples to apples relative to these other emerging market economies, China's well above the median or well below the median. The next chart here, we're just showing sort of short-term external debt as a percentage of foreign exchange reserves. This is the most recent data is updated as of 2Q15. You know, again, China's at 10%, well below the median. You know, definitely, again, you know, it's not like China is just levered up to foreign exchange debt. And to some degree, external currency debt doesn't necessarily capture the bulk of the picture. And so, again, you know, so the next two charts really try to, you know, get a more encompassing look on, you know, really China's foreign currency mismatch risk. And this chart here on the next slide here just shows total inbound portfolio investment as a percentage of non-financial sector credit. So China down 4%, you know, basically foreigners really only own, you know, foreigners are really only allocated to about 4% of China's credit, which is well below the median of 17%. So again, on a peer-to-peer basis, so the apples-to-apples basis relative to other emerging market economies, you know, you should not expect the same sort of capital outflows from China as you saw from, you know, Brazil, Russia, Indonesia, India, et cetera. So, you know, to the extent that you're expecting that to occur in China, you know, we just say that that's sort of misguided. to a general degree. And then just lastly, sort of, you know, obviously the dollar has been perpetuating this, the outflows of emerging markets over the last couple of years, really the last 2 or 3 years. And we're really right in this chart, we're just showing dollar debt as a percentage of foreign exchange reserves. So, you know, if you aggregate all the dollar debt in the economy by local issuers, by sort of offshore issuers from resident companies, and then sort of U.S. dollar-denominated foreign currency loans as well. If you add it all up in China as a percentage of China's foreign exchange reserves, it's only 35%. You know, this is well below the median of 97%. So again, you know, if all the dollars in China left, you know, they'd still have, you know, plenty of foreign exchange reserves to continue propping up the currency or to continue to potentially recapitalize the banking sector. So again, you know, we just sort of try to contextualize this because obviously China, if you think about China in absolutes, yeah, they're dealing with trillions and trillions of dollars. It's really the world's second largest economy. You know, its absolute numbers are substantial. It's gargantuan. You know, the size of their banking sector is gargantuan. I want to say it's about, you know, $35-38 trillion. It's huge, but you know, when you really think about it on the liability risk on a balance sheet, from a balance sheet perspective, rather, China just doesn't necessarily have the same levels of risk as a lot of its peer economies. And maybe the mistake we're making here is evaluating China relative to its peer economies. But you know, you really don't have a choice. You know, you can't really evaluate China relative to a country like the U.S. with a more modern economy and more modern banking system and a banking sector, or even Japan or from the Eurozone for that matter. So you know, we're sort of stuck here. You know, this is where we wash out on it. You know, there's obviously three schools of debate. I think, you know, going back to that original slide, a lot of the debate about the Chinese economy, Chinese yuan, is really centered between the black line and the red line. I don't, you know, if you kind of get laughed out of the room if you're in that green line camp, certainly if you're in the green hooking line up camp. But, you know, we definitely think the outlook is somewhere between the red and black line. We think it's the black line, but we think the appropriate debate to be having is, does China go the path of the red line or the black line there? All right, so going back to the next slide, I want to say slide, here we go. On this chart, you know, we're basically just showing the spread between, you know, the onshore renminbi versus the PBOC's reference rate. So if you go back to sort of August, you know, one of the main reasons they devalued 2-2.5% was effectively to collapse the spread. So there had been a pretty material spread, between the spot rate and what the PBOC was marking the yuan at. And so effectively what the Chinese yuan, what the policymakers wanted to do was sort of alleviate that mark-to-market risk, or at least make their marks, you know, according to market as opposed to model. And what you've seen since is really, you know, you haven't really seen a pretty material delta there that should perpetuate another sort of sharp revaluation like we saw in August. So that, on the margin, that's good, and that's something we expect to continue. You know, definitely sentiment's changing. What we're showing here is the offshore RMB and the spread relative to the onshore RMB. And so because, you know, foreign investors, you know, global capital allocators tend to deal more with the Chinese yuan offshore in Hong Kong, the spread between that rate and the onshore RMB is a good proxy for investor sentiment. And then what you've seen is that, you know, since August and since, you know, really early January, that spread has materially narrowed. You know, so when that spread, when that line is getting red and to the downside, your investors are really betting on, you know, a pretty material sort of a resurgence or pickup in capital flows in China that way in the Chinese offshore yuan. But now that spread is narrowed, is definitely something that's been positive for China on the margin. But you know, there's a few reasons why we think that spread's going to start to widen again and really start to perpetuate another bout of global deflation fears, as we mentioned at the beginning of this call. So on the next slide, we're basically just saying dollar up, yuan down. So again, you know, a lot of what we saw with respect to the PBOC revaluing the yuan sort of lower, you know, really, you know, prior to you know, the last couple of months, but you know, they had been rallying it lower really from, you know, August all the way through early January. And a lot of that is just a function of the big run up in the US dollar index. You know, dollar went from, you know, basically where it is now all the way up to about 100 on the dollar index and just over in the span of a couple of months. And what that did was sort of make China, because the Chinese yuan is more or less, you know, has a managed float relative to the dollar, it made it semi-uncompetitive on the margin relative to its peer currencies, you know, things like the South Korean yuan, the Japanese yen. And so what it wanted to do was to sort of, you know, chase that dollar ascent higher and say, hey, you know, we want to basically keep our currency stable relative to a basket of our peer economies. And so what we're going to do now is effectively just revalue the yuan lower incrementally as the dollar tracks higher, and then revalue the yuan higher incrementally as the yuan tracks lower, because again, they're targeting stability, which is a long-standing tenet of you know, the Chinese Communist Party is stability. change, if you're going to have change, make sure it's slow, make sure it's spread out over 5, 10, 15 years. These guys are, you know, they want to remain in power, and they, you know, when you're dealing with, you know, 1.3, 1.4 billion people who are all aging rapidly with no with no social safety net or very limited social safety net, stability, you know, you don't want to do, you don't want to have too much change, you know, certainly not economically or financial. And so the problem with you know, our expectations for the dollar to climb higher from here is again a reversal of that trend. So the people we expect, you know, as the dollar makes a series of higher lows relative to its peer economies from here, we expect the Chinese yuan, you know, particularly the PBOC fixing, to start to get revalued again to the downside. And again, as we show in this next chart, that's going to be potentially really bad for the inflation trade that we've seen over the last few months. So in this chart, we're effectively just showing the spread in 1 year non-deliverable forwards rates relative to the spot price on the Chinese offshore yuan. And then we're taking the correlations of those versus a bunch of these sort of reflation assets or reflation indices. Since that spread that we just mentioned, the spread between 1 year non-deliverable forward rates and the spot price of the offshore yuan, since it troughed on January 18th. And so we're just telling you, like, effectively, that trough has perpetuated a pretty material degree of reflation. And again, this goes back to the point we make about commodities in general and inflation in general. There's a reason that the dollar matters so much to commodities and commodity inflation. Not to mention, you know, the most basic point is that, you know, global trade and global commodities are settled primarily in dollars to the tune of 86%. But again, if you really want to think about it from a more fundamental perspective, you know, the dollar goes up, tightens financial conditions in China. You know, unless Chinese weakens the yuan, its growth is going to slow on the margin, you know, due to those tightened financial conditions. So unless China can devalue the yuan fast enough to, you know, keep pace with the dollar's ascent, you know, financial conditions on the margin are tightening in China, and Chinese growth is likely to slow. And you're seeing that reflected in inflation trade, both, you know, to the downside and to the upside. These correlations are very, very tight, you know, ranging from 0.8 to 0.82 to 0.92. Those are really, really tight correlations. So again, if the dollar starts to make a series of higher lows from here, expect the PBOC to start to revalue the yuan lower, as it already has started to do this week. You know, expect that to become headline news over the next month or two. And then expect these reflation things to start to sell off again, like we saw sort of in early January and February. So again, and we're just showing that on the next chart again, just showing, you know, the spread in both the onshore yuan and the offshore yuan relative in the non-deliverable forwards markets is really narrowed, but it's just making a series of lower highs. And so again, for you to expect, you know, if you think the reflation trade is going to go higher from here, you're basically effectively saying you're bullish on the Chinese yuan. You're really bearish on the dollar. You expect the Chinese yuan to get revalued materially higher from here. And I don't know anybody that can look me in the eye with a straight face and say they are bullish on the Chinese yuan from here materially. I think it's been a hell of a reflation trade. You know, we definitely got caught off sides, you know, or on the wrong side of that, you know, certainly in the latter part of the move. And that's something we'll take responsibility for. But again, you know, it's all about, you know, today. How are you going to manage risk today to set yourself up for the best opportunities and the best success for tomorrow? And effectively, what we're telling you here is that, you know, the narrowing of the spread, you know, again, in 1 year non-deliverable forwards for both the onshore and offshore yuan, has really reached a pretty asymmetric point. And you really have to make the case that the dollar is going to really break down from here. That perpetuates, you know, a dramatic reversal of capital outflow pressures from China. And in fact, you know, probably hot money inflows back into China from here to support, you know, further reflation in assets from here over the intermediate term. Obviously, you know, I'm not going to sit here and lick my finger in there and say the reflation trade's done today, you know, on April 15th, you know, but what used to be tax day, I guess it's Monday now. But, you know, the point we're making is that, you know, if this chart is actually making a series of lower highs, then reflation itself is effectively making a series of lower highs. And so in the next chart, we just show our GIP model for the United States. Just walking back to quad four, we're in quad four for the second quarter. On the next slide, we're effectively showing you why that matters. So historically, quad four has been the strongest quadrant for the U.S. dollar. Just on this next chart here, dollar up, rates down. Again, so what we're showing effectively is quad four is effectively deflation. Investors tend to get, you know, worried about financial market volatility. Certainly domestic investors, you know, sort of repatriate assets from abroad, and the dollar tends to strengthen as a result of that. And that's something we expect to happen over the intermediate term as both economic data and sort of reported microeconomic data, you know, at the company level starts to slows materially. So we're expecting growth to slow materially. Just as a refresher, we're at 1% GDP for for Q1 with downside to that estimate based on the PCE numbers we're going to get probably I think in 2 weeks, and then negative 0.5 for the second quarter. So again, you know, don't forget that the Atlanta Fed's down at like 0.1 basis points for the first quarter after being at like 2.8% like a month ago. I'm not saying their estimates are any good. In fact, they have a 240 basis point standard error intra-quarter. So again, I'm not take their estimates with a grain of salt, but let's just say they are right. You know, you have flat to negative GDP in the first quarter, and we're following that up with a negative estimate in the second quarter. There is a risk that the U.S. is actually potentially mired in a technical recession, probably a 33% chance of that occurring right now. So definitely that's something that's this not on consensus radar is that, you know, S&P 2075, S&P 2080. Definitely was at S&P sort of, you know, 1809, and it's definitely something we expect to you know, perpetuate a series of lower highs and risk assets from here if we're right on the growth data, both at the macroeconomic level and at the microeconomic level from here. And then just lastly, you know, again, everyone's really talking about QE4 and what they can do. And we'd argue if you think about, you know, swap rates in the U.S., you know, certainly in overnight index swaps and even, you know, even Fed fund futures, the curve, you know, a lot of tightening has been priced out of the market over the last, you know, over the last few months. You know, over the last month or so, the one-year overnight index swap rate has collapsed 10 basis points, you know, versus the policy rate, you know, definitely down 13 basis points year to date. You know, it's definitely something, you know, and it's negative now. You know, this is something, this is a spread that used to be like 50 basis points positive just going back, you know, 3 to 6 months. It's negative now. And so that's a pretty material delta. So the point we're making there is that, you know, how much of, you know, the Fed not tightening has been priced in the financial markets, we'd say a very, very healthy degree, as we discussed on the call yesterday. And, you know, can the Fed preemptively, and I do say this very, very important, this is an important point to make, can the Fed preemptively go to QE4? Or do we have to see 1809 SPX? Do we have to see, you know, $30 crude oil from here? You know, or $28 crude oil from here? You know, do we have to see, you know, basically a redo of January and February, perhaps to new lower lows and across, you know, the high yield credit space and equity space domestically for the Fed to come out, for Janet Yellen to come out and say, okay, we're going to QE. I can't let the market crash in election year. I got to get Hillary elected. Obama, you know, I had my meeting with Obama last week. He told me I got Hillary elected. So maybe they're proactive, maybe they're not proactive. Maybe they have a quick trigger finger, but, you know, we're betting that they're not going to be proactive. We're betting that, you know, that the conditions have to be met for the Fed to go out and do QE from here. So that leaves you in a pretty precarious place if you're sort of holding the bag on inflation today, you know. Golf clap. I mean, actually, no, not a golf clap. I don't want to be trite about it. It was a hell of a trade. If you bought reflation in January and February, you're one of the better investors, you know, in the year to date. I'm guessing your performance is probably in the top decile performance in the year to date. But the point we're making here is, do you want to be holding the bag on inflation? You know, if we're right on the dollar here, if we're right on the Chinese yuan, or right on that negative feedback loop, and with the Fed, you know, potentially being on the sidelines, certainly in April, and then maybe even having to wait all the way to June or July for them to actually come out and do something. And that's pretty negative. And as we saw in early January and February, things can get real nasty in a hurry. And that's a lot of time and space to sort of be holding the bag if you don't have a catalyst for further reflation from here. And just in the next chart, just to wrap it up, you know, we're showing you the broken down belief system in the U.S. So again, you know, you got high yield bond issuance and public equity issuance down over 50% year to date after already having been down 22 and 6% respectively last year. So again, effectively what we're telling you is that, you know, the capital markets don't even buy QE4. You know, there's something is wrong with this chart. If you're telling me, yeah, I'm buying them because I think the Fed's going to go to QE4, yet the economy's capital markets are actually broken down, or breaking down, like, and continuing to break down. I just updated this chart as of today. This is a disaster for April. We're mid-April. You know, so like, I don't know that people actually believe the QE story. I think they just hope that everyone else believes the QE story if you're still long reflation here. So effectively, we're telling you to book the reflation trade. We're telling you the dollar's going to make a series of lower high or higher lows from here. We're telling you the yuan's going to make a series of lower highs from here, and that negative feedback loop's going to start to perpetuate a series of deflation like we saw earlier in the year. And that's been our call, and that's going to remain our call, you know, as we progress through quad four over this next quarter or so, which will obviously be recorded, you know, in the first month of the third quarter as well. And so just finishing up with a few quick charts, you know, again, yesterday, you know, there was a little confusion on the call yesterday, sort of highlighting our tattoo asset class rotation model. And a lot of the signals were, you know, had turned bullish, you know, over the last couple of weeks, you know, effectively saying, hey, we're at a really critical juncture here. either these signals are head fakes like they were in April and in April through sort of June of last year, or you know, we're at a really critical place where the market is pricing in QE4, and as you know, fundamentals always lead. You know, the market prices generally tend to lead fundamentals, and then maybe the market is telling you QE4 is coming and you need to giddy up and get long inflation. Don't forget the conclusion of that call yesterday was that you do not need to giddy up and get long inflation, and hopefully the charts that we just outlined, you know, in this deck, you know, and the explanation really explains why we don't want to get you long inflation here. There'll be a time and price for inflation. I think if you get another flush out and it's very clear the Fed's going to QE4, we're very aware of that playbook, you know, having, you know, like when I started this business in 2009, you know, the only people talking about reflation across the entire global macro space was hedge iris management. You know, so in my opinion, I think we coined the term reflation, or certainly in the post-crisis era. You know, we get the dollar down reflation playbook. You know, that was our Q2 09 macro theme was reflation. we were buying the SPY very low and buying commodities very low at that point. You know, when a lot of people were sort of jumping out the window, so to speak. And so then just lastly again. We're still really negative on the U.S. economy. We're still really negative on the domestic credit cycle. Still really negative on the corporate profit cycle. So these next few charts, we just want to sort of reiterate and hammer those points home. We definitely think you're heading back into the soup here, and that's our call. We're sticking the line in the sand, and not enough people on this side of the table, at least on the sell side, have enough guts to really get out there and make calls. And we wanted to wear our hedge eye shirts today and come in here and say, hey, we're out there. You know, we're going to make these calls. You know, so the next few charts, if you can just turn, Matt, back to the balance sheet health is deteriorating slide. So the black line there just shows corporate debt outstanding as a percentage of net cash flow, free cash flow for the entire economy. And you're basically tracking, you know, relative to previous cycles. You're basically, you're on that up pike, and it could take, you know, just 3 to 6 months to get you back to 4.2 to 4.5 as a debt to cash flow, on a debt to cash flow basis for the entire economy, you know, which has historically been where you tip yourself into recession. And don't forget, this data is as of Q4 2015. So again, by the time the first half of 2016 is over, you could easily be at four and a quarter or four and a half debt to free cash flow. You know, certainly given where free cash flow trends have trended, you know, already in the year to date. Next slide, just this bubble chart. X-axis we're showing treasury bond volatility. Y-axis we're showing high yield credit spreads, and then we're just showing non-financial corporate credit outstanding as a percentage of GDP. In the bubble side, and what we've shown this chart before in previous decks, but the whole point of this chart is that, you know, the economic expansions sort of, you know, they crest at the bottom left of that, little volatility in the bond market, little spread risk, and then once you start to move out to the right, you know, up and to the right, you know, that's generally the late cycle stage of the economy. That's, you know, when people are starting to get worried about the forward outlook for earnings and cash flows and things of that nature, and boom, you know, you get a red dot, you know, so, you know, 2000 to 2002, 1990, you know, 2008, 2009, that's when you get the red dot. And the point we're making is that, you know, once you leave the bottom left of this chart, you get a red dot before you go back to the gray dots. I think there's a lot of people who, you know, are hoping for a gray dot here in 2016. But, you know, the point we're making is that the probability, you know, just based on the last 30 years of data, the probability that you get a red dot is much, 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 much higher than the probability that 2016 is a gray dot. So, again, you know, we're going to be betting on the probabilities and handicapping those risks. And then just this next slide here, corporate profits, you know, we've shown this slide a trillion times. You know, it's one of my favorite charts. You know, anytime corporate profits decline for two consecutive quarters on an economy-wide basis, over the next 12 months, the S&P has a peak-to-trough drawdown of 20% or more. And so, again, you know, we hit that second consecutive quarter in the fourth quarter of 2015 at down 11.5%. You know, that decelerated from down 5.1%. You know, again, just looking at how Q1 earnings season is already starting to track, you know, that's going to continue to decline again, you know, so I don't know what you're buying. I mean, a lot of, you know, even, you know, we've seen, you know, 2 to 3 points of multiple expansion in the year to date, you're really off the lows. And a lot of it's been driven by, you know, a lot of the price action has been driven by multiple expansion rather than, you know, earnings recovery. You know, a lot of people are talking about, well, the dollar's not going up as much anymore, so earnings are going to recover. But you continue to see earnings projectors or earnings estimates trend down. You continue to see corporations cut guidance. You know, so again, it's not what did you buy, because if you bought reflation or in early January and February, that was a hell of a trade. But it's what do you own now is the question we're making today, April 15th. And from here, are you buying more of that stuff? Are you holding it? Or are you selling? And we're effectively giving you all the reasons that you need to be selling it. You know, we didn't give you a reason to go buy it. We told you to cover it, you know, at the beginning of the year, but, you know, we didn't tell you to go buy it and run out and buy it. So, you know, that was our mistake. But again, you know, from here, we're trying to do our best to help people manage risk appropriately from here. And then just these last three slides, you know, we've shown these slides a ton of times as well, but, you know, recession watch is still on the table. You know, we're not, again, I just made the point about the Atlanta Fed and our 2Q estimate. You know, it's, we're still, you know, marking time from the perspective of a recession. So our top three indicators for recession are consumer confidence, jobless claims, and corporate profits. You know, just looking at the spread and the trends in consumer confidence, you know, over the next 8 to 10 months, you know, if we continue to trend sideways or even down from here, you know, you could have that signal, which is identified in those red dots, you know, when the intermediate term trend crosses below the long-term trend in consumer confidence, that typically has been a perfect harbinger of recession over the very immediate term. Jobless claims, you know, we got an awesome print yesterday in jobless claims at 251,000. But the point we're making this chart here is that, you know, is that black line going to go to like 200,000, or is it going to go back up to, you know, 4 to 6? You know, historically, if you go back the last three cycles, you know, we never trend it, you know, this far below or this, you know, for this long, for much longer than 20 months, below 300,000, which seems to be sort of a magic Houdini line. Don't ask me why. You know, we've had a series of discussions internally about why, you know, the changing nature of the labor force would seem to suggest that that shouldn't be the case. But again, it just empirically speaking, it is the case. And it's something we're monitoring from a frequentist probability perspective that, you know, you only have about 6 months left before that line is really hooking up and really careening up to the upside. And then lastly, just corporate earnings on this last slide, just going showing the SP 500 trailing 12-month EPS. Anytime that breaks down below its, you know, intermediate term trend, you tend to get a recession in short order. You know, that happened last June, so, you know, the probability that you're getting a technical recession here or, you know, over the next 3 to 6 months is fairly high, according to this study here. And again, we're not calling for, we're not even modeling recession technically. You know, I mean, we only have one negative quarter of GDP, but the whole point of our recession call is that the market will price in the heightening probability of recession. And like expansions, recessions tend to be very reflexive on the downside, and so much as expansions are reflexive on the upside. So you could just have a recession being perpetuated by, you know, corporate, you know, management teams getting sort of defensive, consumers getting, you know, taking up their savings rate. You know, all this stuff tends to be perpetuated, just like a virtuous economic cycle tends to be perpetuated to the upside. So once you start to get the recession headline risk, like we saw in January and February, that's when people get scared. That's when things tend to start to fall off a cliff. And it's usually elevators up, windows down for both the economy and financial markets in that term. So again, really negative. You know, we definitely want to dress up like hedge eye bears here with the glasses and the turtlenecks. Hope you guys enjoyed that. So I'll just leave it at that and turn it over to Kevin for questions.
Perfect. No, that was great. This first one here. Has the Fed re-engaged to stop the dollar depreciation that began in 11 to benefit Europe and Japan? And is that the real reason for the rally in U.S. equities? The currency war has switched fronts once again.
Yes, perhaps. Certainly the Janet Yellen punting on the dot plot and really coming out particularly dovish. And we wouldn't say just marginally dovish. She's been pretty dovish in the year to date. That's definitely been a key, you know, a key factor in driving sort of the currency war. But, you know, we would argue that she's not necessarily doing this for Europe and Japan or for emerging markets. She's doing this because we had 1,800 on the S&P, you know, in February. She's doing this because we were, you know, it's headline news. I mean, you have CNBC running recession risk every day. It was headline news that the economy was slowing. It was a very late cycle when the markets were pricing in a pretty material credit cycle. And so that's why she did it. The point we're making with the belief system is that as she's doing that, you know, Europe and Japan are taking the brunt of the current foreign currency or of the currency appreciation risk, and that's dramatically weighing on their capital markets, you know, certainly in asset price terms and also in corporate profitability terms. And, you know, what point do those guys come out and say enough is enough? No. You know, we're not going to keep taking crashing markets. You know, the Euro Stoxx 600 is down like 20% from its peak to trough. So is the Topix and the Nikkei. You know, at what point do these guys come out and say enough is enough? And if they do come out and say enough is enough and try to you know, stimulate pretty aggressively from here, do their currencies go up on that anyway? And at what point does the market just say none of this stuff works? You know, again, we're going back to that capital markets slide we showed. You know, you had high yield equity issuance down 55-60% year over year. You know, people don't buy it anymore. I think there's a multiple expansion based on some very astute investors, probably a lot of quant investors making a hell of a trade. But you know, I don't know that people buy that QE and all this sort of you know policy stimulus works. You know, certainly not on the monetary front. You know, the big thing that could be very positive for all these economies is an expansionary fiscal policy. But again, you know, certainly with the election coming up, you know, we're probably a long ways away from that in the U.S. That's probably more of a 2017 event domestically.
Next one, with GDP edging towards 0% and company earnings looking disastrous, what are S&P bears missing?
Well, I think S&P bears missed a dramatic short squeeze. You know, I mean, hopefully people didn't ride it the whole way up. You know, hopefully there's some astute risk management there, you know, along the way for you know, for our clients and, you know, and our subscribers. But the point is, you know, again, markets bounce, bear markets bounce. I mean, I think I sent this note to our top clients in like, oh man, maybe it might've been December of 2014. The note was titled like bear markets bounce. Like, we think we're going into a bear market. Don't freak out when the market rallies. You know, we've had like three material reflation rallies since then. I actually had a really long call with a longtime client yesterday, and you know, he was talking to me about some of the other research providers he's using, and he cited a statistic that they showed is that, you know, the median return of bear market rallies is like 16 or 17% historically. You know, we're really just tracking along that. Like, you know, if you bought the stock market in like 1932, or, you know, and route to another like 50% decline, or like, you know, even in like October 08, that's the whole point of this exercise. It's, you know, bear markets are really hard. You know, bear markets don't really end until bulls and bears are losing money. You know, it's hard to risk manage a bear market, and, you know, we're definitely not saying we're nailing it by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, Keith did issue a bunch of cover signals, you know, in early February, and, you know, we're not going to, you know, shy away from, you know, taking credit for that. You know, now, did we maybe short it a little bit too early? Of course, you know, but again, you know, we have a really negative view. You know, we don't expect, you know, the bear markets to have, we didn't expect the markets to react as aggressively as they've had for, you know, for the Fed effectively just, you know, taking down its dot plot. But it is what it is. And, you know, again, we're here April 14th or April 15th, rather. You know, what's the call from today? You know, leave the baggage at home, leave the emotional response at home, you know, leave your P&L at home. Wake up today, turn your computer on, open your notebook, and figure out what you need to do today. You know, what play do we need to call today? And the play we're calling today is deflation from here.
Just to elaborate on that a little bit, how much longer would the S&P have to stay above 2066 for you to take your bearish stance off?
Yeah, so it's going to be more than that. It's got to come sort of from four material factors. S&P's got to break out above and hold above 2066. 10-year Treasury yield's got to break out above and hold above 2.27 on the tail line. So I mean, we're where's Waldo with that, and that's one of the key reasons we're ardent to maintain our bear positions, because, you know, you still have these really defensive style factors leading the market, not necessarily leading the market, but it's keeping pace with the market certainly. If you think about quality stocks or dividend stocks or, you know, even utilities and whatnot, you know, and treasuries, they haven't really sold off, you know, to the extent that the market has rallied. You know, it's telling you that, you know, the bear case is right fundamentally, and that, you know, you're going to be wrong for a short squeeze. Don't forget, you know, we hit almost two standardizations oversold on the net futures and options positioning to the short side of the SPYs, you know, in early February. And I was on this call, like, I think on February 7th, saying, like, hey, we're at that oversold place. Like, there's going to be a short squeeze here. You always get a counter-trend bounce or a counter-trend reversal anytime you get, you know, plus two or minus two standardizations oversold on a Z-score basis in the futures and options market. And that's exactly what we got. And the point we're making now is that, you know, you've consolidated that position all the way back to flat. You know, so are we bullish from here? Maybe, but, you know, we would argue that based on the fundamentals and how the quality trade and the bond market is reacting, you know, to this rally, which is very, in a very muted fashion, we would definitely say that, you know, the fundamentals are likely to win out from here.
Next one here, low volume is one of your main components for saying this rally is unsustainable, yet we've rallied a long way for a long time. Is volume therefore irrelevant when you're deciding market direction?
No, volume is not irrelevant. Volume is irrelevant at critical points. And I think, you know, so if you go back to 2009, or, you know, like, market volume has been in structural decline really since the crisis, and certainly, you know, liquidity and fixed income markets as well. So again, you know, if you plot it like a long-term chart of volume, it goes this way, and then a long-term chart of S&P 500 goes that way. So volume is not a directional indicator, but what it is, you know, so over the longer periods of time, but over short periods of time when markets are in and around critical sort of levels, and we consider, you know, the 2066 level a very critical level, you know, is the market breaking out above that line, you know, in this sort of shortened time period on rising volume, or is the volume sort of decelerating as we get above that line or as we approach that line? You know, that's the real point about volume. It's not necessarily just saying, well, is volume trending up or is price trending down, you know, like it's bearish or vice versa. you know, that's not necessarily helpful because, again, if you pull up a long-term chart of volume, it's not going to tell you anything. But in shortened windows, so, you know, like ones we were in today, it's like, is the volume confirming, you know, what could be a bullish breakout? And the answer to that is no.
Gotcha. Just a point to clarify here. Did you say markets were turning marginally bullish on oil and marginally bearish on the U.S. dollar?
Yes, on the margin. So again, well, the oil is always in a structural bull market from a net futures and options positioning perspective. But again, so what we, you know, what we look at when we look at futures and options positioning, you know, from that perspective, we're always trying to find it relative to itself. You know, we want to standardize things. So you know, on a Z-score basis, you know, you have crude oil, nat gas, all these things are breaking out above one, which is not necessarily it's not a perfect back test in terms of, you know, that one threshold. But certainly, as you approach two, you tend to start to get reversals. And so we're basically getting to the point where, like, the squeeze in oil, the squeeze in the energy complex, and really across a lot of the commodity complex, is getting to the point where it's exhausted. Now, they could, you know, start to continue to run up a little bit from here, but we're definitely making the point that it is, in fact, getting exhausted. And then just on the dollar, like, you know, the dollar still, and there's still a net long bias in the dollar. But again, that's come all the way down to minus two standard deviations below its trailing 12-month average. And, you know, don't forget that dollar futures and options positioning peaked, you know, last March around 84,000 contracts, where we're at now like 17,000. You know, so again, you know, you have to make the case, you know, from here that the dollar's breaking down and we'll go into a structural net short, you know, as it was for really most of the post-crisis era, or at least prior to sort of 2013, 2014. Or, you know, is this just a really, really massive, super exhausted, really painful consolidation in what had become the most consensus trade across, you know, really the global macro and really the entire asset allocation spectrum, which is long dollar short reflation. You know, so like anytime you get a trade like that that's super consensus, you tend to get a pretty material, you know, painful reversal, and then we're calling for that, you know, at least over the intermediate term, for that reversal to reverse.
Gotcha. And then just a process question here. What do you mean by quad four?
So quad four. So if, Matt, you can pull up slide five in our themes deck. So we model the economy from, you know, two things. We model the economy stochastically in terms of generating our growth and inflation forecast. But more importantly than that, we're always looking at the economy on a second derivative basis. So this is our GIP model. It's sort of the hallmark of our fundamental process, which really derives or really, you know, it's the source of our asset allocation process. So we, you know, we try to identify what economy, what quadrant we're in, and what quadrant we're likely headed to, as it relates to you know, using historical data to project an appropriate asset allocation, you know, and factor exposure selections to be in, from that perspective. So quad four is in that bottom left box there, and on the x-axis we're showing the second derivative in headline inflation. On the right, on the y-axis, we're showing the second derivative in year-over-year real GDP growth, and that's a pretty material delta from how we look at the economy and look at the world. We look at it, you know, as you would look at a company, as investors, we look at a company. You know, don't forget, you know, our backgrounds are all, for the most part, you know, equity research and you know, either on the buy side or the sell side. So, you know, again, we think about things, you know, from a micro perspective, but then we apply those same concepts of, you know, rate of change and year-over-year growth to the overall economy. And what we're seeing here is that in the second quarter of this year, you know, nominal GDP growth is going to slow. It should slow pretty sharply. You know, we have a deceleration in inflation. We have a deceleration in real GDP growth, and that's going to be, you know, historically that has proven really, really negative for risk assets. But, you know, the things that it has proven very, very positively for historically, you know, are very, very extremely defensive style factor exposures. In the equity market, it's been very, very positive for treasury bonds and really, really high grade corporates. And it's been very, very positive for the US dollar and Japanese yen, Swiss franc. So basically, it's just a risk off trade. You know, buy volatility, buy the dollar, buy treasuries, buy utes, and sell everything else. And that's historically what we've seen. You know, we saw that in the second half of 2014. Really, we saw that all throughout the second half of 2008 and the first half of 2009. You know, we saw that throughout a lot of the time, and then from 2000 to 2002. That's quad four. That's what it looks like. And, you know, if we're in quad four, you know, we're basically playing the averages, you know, going back to the back test table we show on the next slide, on slide six. You know, it's not something you can probably see on the screen, but, you know, we're playing the averages in that table, saying, hey, quad four says do this, and so we're going to do that. And unless we get a signal either fundamentally or quantitatively that says don't do that, we're going to do that. And right now, those signals are telling us, for the most part, to stay in the quad four playbook.
I've recently read that China has only delayed and amplified the inevitable forex pressures by using forwards, thus they're even more short euro dollars. Can you just elaborate on this a little bit?
Yeah, of course. I mean, they're basically forcing their banks to take on long won exposure by using forwards, and effectively, so that just creates an open-ended liability for the PBOC, on those bank balance sheets. But the point we're making, I guess the premise of the question misses the point that these are state-run enterprises, and they're not gonna close those positions without permission. And so again, yes, it does increase risk in the system, but again, you can't. We made this point at a client meeting on Tuesday. You can't think about China, risk in China and the Chinese financial market and economy, from the same perspective that we think about risk in a capitalist, Western economy. These banks aren't gonna just wake up one day and say, hey, well, we want to be short the yuan again. No. PBOC is gonna jam dollar forwards down your throat, and you're gonna like it. And you're gonna love it. And that's the whole point. And that's not gonna stop until it stops, until they find a reason to stop doing it. And maybe I'm naive to think that these guys have it all under control. And again, I don't think they have it under control. I just think that, on the margin, the sudden stop, material devaluation, huge, large-scale capital outflow risk is not something that China necessarily possesses, due to the structure and nature of its economy, its state-run financial system, and its capital account. I just think it's more likely to be a continuation of, of what we've seen, which is something we got ahead of in 2011, which, China's got to let a lot of air out of the system. It's got to have a very passive deleveraging, and it's likely to do that. And it's, if you buy some semblance of the growth numbers, which is obviously slowed on a long-term basis, they've been doing that. The problem is that the economy's gotten more levered along the way. They're going to have to do, some other things and be more creative to sort of delever the economy. And one of the ways we thought they would do that last year was just perpetuating a large-scale equity market bubble, which could obviously inflate asset prices and make corporations less levered on the margin from that perspective. But again, the market's got in front of that. People were literally leveraging their homes, to lever up in the margin and buying stocks ahead of that, because I think everyone got ahead of that trade. And so that's something they're going to have to fix and address. But again, China, I'm really negative on China. I just think it plays out over a much longer term time period than I think, the most ardent bears perhaps, believe.
And then another one just to clarify here, a little confused. You're anticipating higher lows in the dollar, but still only 18% of your max exposure is invested in gold and commodities. What am I missing?
So we're anticipating higher lows in the dollar, which means the dollar is going to start to trend higher from here, which means we need to be taking down our commodity exposure on the margin, to the extent that the historical quad four asset allocation proves correct for this current setup. So again, dollar up, yuan down, reflation down is the call from here. It's really the call we've been making, and on the margin, in the last few points of the squeeze we've been wrong, but it's definitely a call we're pounding the table on today. Definitely have our glasses and our sweatshirts on for a reason. We're hedge eye bears, and we're not going to apologize for it.
And then just a couple more here. Mm-hmm. What data can you point to that indicates pending credit deterioration? I expected to see an uptick in NCOs and NPLs and some of these large cap banks in the first quarter 16 prints. But in actuality, these metrics were stable slash a little lower. And early delinquencies appear to be at 30-year low still. Any thoughts?
Yeah, my first thought is that if you're buying banks because you're at the top of the credit cycle, i.e. Delinquencies and NPLs are low, God help you and God bless you, because that's a really dangerous place to be buying any financial institution. Secondly, if you go to slide 28 in our macro themes deck, we're showing the senior loan officer survey data, and we're just showing sort of the net percentage of banks, throughout a variety of the survey questions, just net percentage of banks effectively tighten credit for consumers and corporations, and that continues to trend higher, throughout the first quarter of the senior loan officer survey data. And what you see in this chart is that anytime you start to trend higher off the cycle trough, which is easing standards, you don't go back. Like, that's the whole point we made with the bubble chart, is that once you move off the cycle trough and easing and cycle trough and credit spreads and cycle trough and fixed income volatility, you start to peak in terms of cycle trough and credit, both as a relationship to GDP and also as a relationship to assets and free cash flow. You don't go back. Once the credit cycle turns, it turns. We could be dead wrong on this, but it would be the first time ever the credit cycle has turned and didn't stay turned. you know, like, I'm not smart enough. You know, I have, you know, you and I have, you know, pretty expensive degrees from a very fine institution. I'm still not smart enough to say the credit cycle is going to turn and turn backwards. You know, maybe it hangs out for a couple more quarters and then shoots up and you get a big red bar. You know, that would be a call in and of itself. But again, you know, I'm not smart enough to make that call either. All I can tell you is that that black line's headed higher.
And the last one here, bit of a long one, so. Mm-hmm. So if you think you're in quad four, where you say the policy response is likely dovish, are you assuming that the market reprices before the policy response? Mm-hmm. Because if the policy response comes early, short SPX positions are only going to get uglier. It feels to me like the market is moving as if there's already been a policy response.
Yeah, the market has moved. There has been a policy response. So again, we made the point earlier, index swap rates and Fed funds futures is already priced out tightening over the next 12 months or so, even going out 2 years, you know, in certain markets. So again, there has been a policy response. The market is appropriately priced in the fact that the Fed is probably not going to hike interest rates in 2015. That we know. The point we're making with quad four is, if you go to slide 58 in that macro theme stack, is that, you know, historically speaking, even though the policy response is dovish, it A, always comes in a lag to the reported data, because, you know, policymakers are, you know, they dot their I's and they cross their T's and they're government bureaucrats, but also that when bad is bad, it's just bad. And so this chart here, we're showing you that, you know, when you're in a recession or you're creeping towards a recession and things are just getting bad, these are all historical material quad four setups. You know, they're all recessions. You know, you go back to the early 90s, the Fed cut rates 125 basis points, but the market still went down almost 20%. You know, early 2000s, the market got cut in half. The Fed cut rates 525 basis points, which is dramatically much more easing than they could possibly even imagine doing right now with QE4. I think the beauty of QE is that no one really knows how it works. So, like, you know, like, it's like, is this like a 500 basis point cut or is this like a 2 basis point cut? No one really knows. So they managed to bamboozle a lot of, you know, really astute professional investors with that. But again, you know, even going back to the Great Recession, you know, which is, again, I don't want to miss words, that's a really, you know, distinct period in time. I don't want to compare this setup to that. What we're experiencing now is much more akin to the CNI-led slowdown of the early 2000s, when the Fed cut rates 525 basis points and the market still got cut in half. You know, we're at like 90% power or something on forward earnings, like, multiples, historically speaking. You know, CAPE multiples are pretty high. Tobin's Q is pretty high. They're not at, you know, dot-com bubble highs, but, you know, if the bull case on stocks is that, you know, multiples are going to go to dot-com bubble highs, and, you know, I think this country, you know, hasn't learned a damn thing in the last 15 to 20 years, and certainly our profession hasn't, and that would just be really sad for you know, millennials like us.
That's all we have in the queue. A nice little comment here. Glad to see you guys back with some confidence this morning. Adapt, improvise, and overcome. I think it's the shirts.
It's definitely the turtlenecks.
If you guys are in the market for a slightly oversized white mock tee, let me know.
All right, we'll wrap it up there. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, guys. Thanks, Dave.